what companies with Massachusetts employees need to know. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Kate Pirelli. You may begin.
Thank you very much, and welcome everyone to the webinar today. We're delighted to be here to talk with you about this fairly significant change in Massachusetts law on non-competes and trade secrets. This has been a 10-year effort of the legislator and a lot of other folks involved with the legislature in Massachusetts. The three panelists today, which I'll tell you a little bit about us in just a moment, have been very involved in watching this effort over the 10-year time frame. In fact, we've seen several children born just to this panel alone, a marriage, partnership at the law firm. So a lot of our life has passed us by as we've watched this effort underway since 2008, really, it began. Let's go to the next slide, please. Agenda. So, actually, go back to the introductions. No, you're good. So we're going to cover several points, why the law was enacted, when it's going to take effect, who's covered by the law, what's covered by the law, and how it will affect Massachusetts employers, and some suggestions on things to do or considering to do. So next slide, Doyne. So our panelists today, myself, Kate Pirelli, as was indicated, I am a commercial litigator. I've spent a good portion of my career advising clients on restrictive covenants, not only drafting and implementing them, but litigating those issues, as well as advising on protections of confidential information and trade secrets. I also chair the litigation department here at SIFARTH. Along with me today is Eric Weibust, whose practice is similar to mine, litigates trade secrets, works with multi-jurisdictional employers on implementing such agreements and also litigating disputes around them. And Don Mertonite also practices in this area, advising on the same types of agreements and litigating them. We've all litigated cases together for years now, so we're delighted to be with you today. Let's turn to the meat of the matter. Why was the law enacted? As I said, this debate has gone on for 10 years, but we thought we'd share a little bit about the influencers of why we think it was finally enacted and why the efforts started when they did back in 2008, and also talk a little bit about the history of what's gone on since then, and very briefly, just to give you some context for where we've landed today. So in terms of policy considerations, you know, the debate has always been, and the balance that courts have tried to strike over the years is an employee's ability to move between jobs versus the employer's business, protecting employer's business interests of goodwill, confidential information, and trade secrets. And the courts have tried to strike that balance when they're in litigation determining whether they're going to enforce restrictive covenants, particularly non-competes. And at least in my view, and other panelists can comment on this as we go on, I think the courts have done a fairly decent job of striking that balance over the years and modifying agreements to the extent they're overbroad or not enforcing them at all if too overbroad or inapplicable to the situation. But there are those out in the business community that disagree with that. The other thing that has occurred, I think, since the early debate around non-competes is that many employers typically early on in the usage of non-competes use them primarily for unique employees employees who had unique access to trade secrets and confidential information or customer relationships, that type of thing. But over time, some employers have broadened the employee population that are subject to non-competes, including more rank and file employees, sometimes lower wage employees, sometimes referred to as rank and file employees. And that has caused a fair amount of consternation in the community and actually a fair amount of agreement, even by those who are proponents of non-compete, that those types of employees really shouldn't be covered by restrictive covenants or non-competes particularly. I'm sure some of the examples that are cited to in this context are sandwich makers, for example, warehouse personnel. Camp counselors, even recently in Massachusetts, were under fire for violating non-compete. So I think those drove a lot of the discussion. Those situations have driven a lot of the discussion around who should be subject to these. Again, I think the courts have done a nice job of striking a balance and not enforcing in those instances. But many have thought, and I think the legislature thought, that the fact of the agreement in and of itself has a chilling impact on these types of employees. They're costly to defend, and sometimes they wouldn't try to defend them at all or challenge the agreements, I should say, just given the cost involved. Another influencer that non-competes chill innovation. That's been a debate that has gone on the last several years. There are some commentators, researchers, many in the venture capital community have argued and cite to studies that such agreements are bad for innovation, entrepreneurship, and employee mobility. The proponents of this view often cite to the performance of tech companies in the Silicon Valley in the 80s and 90s versus the performance of tech companies along Route 28. Seems like a while ago now, but they've argued that the poor performance of some of the tech companies on 128 versus those in the Silicon Valley, they blame it on the existence of non-competes. California, of course, prohibits non-compete agreements. Massachusetts has enforced them for years, if reasonable. And many think that that's one of the main reasons Route 128 struggled in the 80s and 90s. In fact, there was a book written back in 1994 that a lot of folks cite to by a woman named Annalise Saxenian called The Regional Advantage, which explored the cultural and competitive differences between Silicon Valley and Route 128. Others have pushed back on that view, that it's much more complicated than a cultural difference. Some have pointed to the fact that, the big tech companies along 128 focused on the mini computer, the washing machine-sized computer that replaced the mainframes that had preceded them versus what was going on in Silicon Valley, which were, the focus was on PC, which were much smaller and cheaper devices, and the 128 business community, tech community, didn't keep up with that pace. Another thing that we've talked about here and that have been cited recently by folks who favored keeping non-competes and reforming them instead of banning them altogether was the low unemployment rate in Massachusetts versus the unemployment rate in California, the very strong rise of the pharma and biopharma and life sciences industry in Boston and Cambridge. The presence of non-competes in that industry didn't seem to stifle innovation. So the debate, I guess, will continue, but those are some of the influencers that we think brought along the legislative efforts that started in 2008. And as I said, it started back then. Senator Bill Brownsberger, who's a senator representing parts of Suffolk County and Middlesex, filed a bill that would have banned non-competes altogether. Massachusetts would have joined the California ranks. At the same time, Lori Ehrlich, who's a state rep from the 8th District of Essex, filed a bill that was more of a codification, rather, of common law Both of them decided to combine efforts sometime in the spring of 2009 and focused on compromise bill that would have kept non-competes, but codified the common law and then focused on procedural protections for employees versus banning them altogether. Those efforts continued over time. I mean, every year there was a bill or several bills ranging from banning them altogether to including provisions, many of the similar provisions as we'll talk about in the current bill that goes into effect this fall, ranging from six-month restrictions to 1 year to prohibiting agreements for low-wage earners and non-exempt workers. There were garden leave provisions on and off in these bills over the years. You may recall that Governor Patrick came out in favor of banning non-competes altogether, was not successful during his administration to pass such a bill. Governor Baker, more recently, prior to the passage of this bill, voiced support for reform around non-competes, but as far as I know anyway, he never outright supported a complete ban on them. So last year, and then before this year, last year there was a bill that we expected had a very good chance of passing, and all bets were that it was going to pass, and at the last moment a garden leave provision was added to it, and the bill failed because of that. That was the big straw that broke the camel's back for passage. And here we are today to talk about the finally a compromise version of the many, many bills that have come before. It does include a garden leave provision. You'll hear more about that when Eric presents, but a much more watered down version than what has appeared in previous bills and which caused the bill to fail last year. And it's also part of the bill is part of a very long and broader economic bill that touches upon a number of issues to help improve the economy. Next slide. So when does it take effect? October 1 is the effective date of this year. It's not retroactive to agreements signed before. We'll discuss later on in the presentation, you know, what employers should do about agreements that were signed before October 1 of this year and whether or not it makes sense to review those or update them, but more to come on that. So who's covered by the law? And there's some significant changes here from existing law. Just as the previous bill last year that just almost passed, this bill, many of the bills, included, obviously, employees. But this one and a couple of the previous versions of it also includes independent contractors. Not quite sure I've ever understood the inclusion of independent contractors in this particular bill. I haven't heard any real debate around that issue. There's certainly no discussion in the bill on why they're included. The only thing that I can attribute that to is perhaps to avoid an end run by employers wanting a restrictive or a non-compete agreement to be in place and feeling like they'd have more leeway with an independent contractor if they weren't covered by this bill. That's the only thing that makes any sense to me. There are specific exclusions from who is covered under the law. As I mentioned before, the big concern has been sort of lower-level employees or hourly employees was one provision that was in a previous bill. What the legislature finally agreed on was excluding non-exempt employees as determined under the Fair Labor Standards Act and excluding them from coverage of this or from non-competes altogether, I should say. And non-exempt employees, of course, there's lots of definition around that. The FLSA is not terribly different than the Massachusetts definition of a non-exempt employee. Typically, those people who are entitled to overtime pay. But what constitutes non-exempt is beyond the scope of this particular webinar, but certainly should check in with your employment counsel on who would be excluded from this from non-competes altogether. Also, undergraduate and graduate students who are at an internship, whether paid or unpaid, while they're fully enrolled in school, they cannot be subject to a non-compete. I'm going to skip a bullet here and come back to it. And then employees who are 18 years or old or younger. Again, that's been a concern in previous years about too broad with folks that age. And then finally, the biggest change for Massachusetts law is employees who have been terminated without cause or if they are laid off cannot be subject to a non-compete that's not enforceable against them. Up until now, that was not the case. There was no exclusion for those two. So that's a big change in the law. There's no definition of cause in the statute. There's no real common law definition of what cause constitutes. Typically, cause terminations are defined by contracts and include such things as a material dereliction of duties, you know, crimes of moral turpitude, not acting in the best interest of the company, things like that. It's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out, but it, in my view, changes the at-will nature of the employment relationship for those who are terminated with agreements that employers want to enforce, gives the employee the right to a quote, just cause, close quote, termination, essentially, which you know, may likely lead to litigation around whether the employee has been terminated for just cause. And maybe those litigations or negotiations around a severance package to compensate the person for being put in this sort of purgatory of determining whether it's a just cause or cause termination. So I think it's going to create a lot of issues for companies. It's a fairly significant change and one that needs to be thought about. The other problem with this provision too is the specter of inconsistent application of terminations for the same reason. Terminating someone for cause and then terminating another person for similar conduct for no cause, you may run the risk of treating people in a protected class differently from those not in a protected class for similar termination reasons, but calling it something different. That too can lead to litigation. So there's going to have to be extra care given to the reasons given to employees around termination if they have a restrictive covenant agreement. Next slide. What's covered by the law? Non-competes, obviously, and forfeiture for competition agreements, which are often provisions which are often combined with a clawback of requiring an employee to pay back compensation following joining a competitor. So it sort of takes a different form than a typical just straight out non-compete agreement. Those types of agreements will now be analyzed under the statute's requirements. Excuse me. Excluded from the act, and this has been true with some of the other previous attempts at reform, employee non-solicits are not covered by this act. Customer, client, and vendor non-solicits are not covered. Agreements in the context of a sale of a business where the party restricted is the significant owner of or a member or partner in the business being sold. This has essentially been the common law, but now it's codified into the statute. Agreements outside of the employment relationship, franchise agreements, distributorship agreements, things like that. Forfeiture agreements, so long as they don't include forfeiture for competition. Non-disclosure agreements, confidentiality agreements, those are outside of the coverage of the statute. And separation agreements are outside, so long as the employee is expressly given 7 business days to rescind the acceptance thereof. So that might be a way to bind employees that you're worried about firing for a lack of cause. That's more on that later in the discussion. And then also, excluded are no rehire agreements. So if someone has been terminated and agreed not to reapply to the company to the same position, those are excluded. And then this notion of springing non-competes, there's a provision in the statute that allows, as a remedy, a non-compete to be imposed if someone has, if an employee has violated another form of restrictive covenant, like a non-solicit of a customer employee. Frankly, I see this, you know, we're kind of a little puzzled about how this will work in reality, but more to follow on that as the law continues. I'm going to turn it over to Eric Wybus now.
Thank you, Kate. And now I'm sure we'll get into a question that I'm sure everybody on this webinar has, which is how is this going to affect me and my company? And we'll start generally and then work down more narrowly into some of the issues that we know you have questions on, particular consideration and garden leave and the choice of law type of questions. So generally speaking, for new employees or prospective employees, an agreement not to compete must be in writing and signed by both the employer and the employee. Oftentimes, up until now, just the employee will sign. So it's not a huge change, but it is a change and will be will affect certain HR folks who are responsible for collecting signatures. We question whether or not an electronic signature or a pre-printed signature on the employer's behalf will be sufficient. We don't see why it wouldn't be, but we know that those issues have been litigated in the past. The agreement must expressly state that the employee has the right to consult with counsel prior to signing. I think oftentimes this goes without being said. Lower level employees typically won't engage counsel. They'll just sign what's put in front of them, but oftentimes senior executive types will engage counsel. And now you actually have to specifically state in the agreement, in order for it to be enforceable, that the employee has the right to consult with counsel. So that's something that will need to be added to agreements. And the agreement must be provided to the employee either when the formal offer of employment is made or 10 business days before the commencement of employment, whichever comes first. Again, this is a change to current law, and we question what the effect will be on employees that you need to start within 10 days, and whether this is waivable. And if you could put language in the agreement that says by signing this before the 10 days are up, you're waiving the right to the 10 days. And how, obviously, if there's bargaining power, if there's pressure or duress on that, it will come out during litigation. But if you need somebody to start sooner, then there's certainly, we think, an opportunity to put that type of language in and make it clear what you're doing and why. And finally, as has always been the law, it has to be reasonable in scope. A lot of the same general requirements apply also to existing employees who have worked for your company for some time, with a few notable exceptions, the most notable of which, in our view, is that continued employment is no longer sufficient consideration. And we'll get into the consideration issue in more depth, but for now I'll just say that what the statute says is that for an existing employee, they have to be provided with fair and reasonable consideration independent from the continuation of employment. And again, that's very vague and wishy-washy, and we'll get into what we think that means and how we think that will play out. And otherwise, existing employees have the same restrictions as new employees. Have to be given 10 days before the effective date of the agreement. It must be in writing, must be signed by both parties, once again. It must expressly state that the employee has the right to consult with counsel, and again, it must be reasonable in scope. So again, generally and broadly, non-compete agreements, like any other restrictive agreement, still have to protect a legitimate business interest. You can't just impose a non-compete agreement on somebody because you want to or to protect yourself from ordinary competition. You have to be protecting what's called legitimate business interests. And those interests are the same under the statute as they have been under the common law. And they include trade secrets, confidential information, and goodwill. And again, like everything in this area of law, it's very fact-intensive. The new language here in the statute is interesting because it provides that if the business interest that you're trying to protect, whether it's trade secrets, confidential information, or goodwill, cannot be protected by another type of restrictive covenant agreement, such as a non-solicitation or a confidentiality, then the non-compete will be presumed necessary and presumed reasonable. Now, it's unclear whether, obviously that's very fact-intensive, and it's also unclear whether there are certain judges, in particular those who are looking not to enforce these things, will take the opposite approach and say, well, if these other agreements, the non-solicit, the confidentiality, are sufficient, are adequate, then necessarily the non-compete agreement is presumptively unreasonable. And again, it's brought to light by the statute. It's not really a new issue. Oftentimes, a defendant will raise the fact that they're already subject to confidentiality and non-solicitation. They intend to comply with those, and therefore the non-compete's unnecessary. And we litigate that all the time, even without the statute. So that's not a big change, but it does give these judges who don't want to enforce these things a new hook to hang their hat on, if you will. The permissible scope in terms of time, there's a new change here and a pretty significant one, and that's that non-compete agreements cannot be longer than 1 year, with one exception. and talk about the exception momentarily, but in the past, non-compete agreements of one and a half years, 5 years, different time periods have been allowed under the right circumstances when you're talking about senior executives or people with the keys to the kingdom, so to speak. Longer agreements have certainly been enforced, but now those would no longer be allowed. You're only entitled to a one-year non-compete agreement. Now, there is an exception for this where an employee breaches his or her fiduciary duty or has unlawfully taken physically or electronically property belonging to the company, the agreement can be extended to 2 years. So again, we question how this will work in practice. Our view, at least my view on this, is that this law doesn't really create any new kind of independent rights. What it does is it tells you what you can and can't do in a contract and what you must do in a contract. And so therefore, we would, and we'll get into what our suggestions are down the road, but our suggestion is that if you're going to try to take advantage of a provision like this and trigger the 2 years based upon a breach, that you write it into the agreement and say your agreement is for 1 year unless we have evidence that you breached your fiduciary duty or stole property, in which case it automatically extends to 2 years. And we'll see what the courts do with that. But if you stay silent on it, it's very unlikely that a court will just automatically extend it, similar to the springing non-compete idea that Kate talked about a few minutes ago. The scope, geographic scope, again, is very much the same as it was before. There is a presumption of reasonableness where the scope is limited to where the employee provided services or had a material presence or influence over the past 2 years. Again, that's typically been the standard that the courts will apply, and that largely comes from the common law, but this presumption of reasonableness is a new thing under the law. And as far as the scope of prescribed activities, again, this is the same as the common law. It's got to be reasonable, and typically it's got to be limited to what the employee was doing for you in the last 2 years. So if they were a salesperson, you're not going to be able to prohibit them from working in any role for another company. You hear the classic of example of saying that the person can't go work for a competitor as a janitor. Under this, it would have to be limited to what they were doing. And if you need to protect other things because they have confidentiality concerns or customer concerns, you can certainly protect those through other types of restrictive covenant agreements. So now, on to consideration, which I know we all know is the big issue that we've been hearing the most about from our clients and that we've gotten the most questions about. And although there are certainly some consequential changes in regards to consideration, they're not necessarily where you would think they would be initially reading the statute or reading articles about it. Every single person who's called me, at least, has asked about this garden leave provision, which we'll get into momentarily. And that, in my view, at least, is one of the less consequential provisions of this bill, including in relation to consideration. We'll talk about that in a moment. But let's start with an overview. Again, so for existing employees, as we know, continued employment is no longer sufficient. That's a big consequential change. And instead, they must be provided with fair and reasonable consideration, which we'll talk about. And for new and existing employees, so for all employees, in order for the consideration to be sufficient or adequate, it must either include garden leave, which is defined in the statute essentially as 50% of the person's average base salary over the past 2 years. And you have to pay it out to them over the term of the restrictive covenant. Or, and this is why we don't think it's all that consequential, and it was watered down in the political process, or other mutually agreed upon consideration that has to be set forth or specified in the agreement. And again, this is where we're getting the most questions, and it certainly is the most confusing and creates the most uncertainty and where we'll likely see most litigation occur because of that. And we actually penned an op-ed in Mass Lawyers Weekly, if you have access to that, about these confusion caused by this. We'd be happy to send you a copy of that. But essentially, the garden leave itself is clearly not mandated. You can do something else. And that begs the question of what does any of this really mean? It's very wishy-washy, very watered down. So let's start with what garden leave is. Essentially what it is you're paying somebody to sit on the sidelines. You're paying them to sit out. And if you're going to provide garden leave, it has to be, as I said, 50% of the employee's highest annualized base salary within the past 2 years of their employment. Now, there are exceptions to this in that, again, you can provide other consideration, which we'll talk about. But there is a requirement that an employee cannot unilaterally discontinue the garden leave payment if that's what you've chosen to go with and that's what you've provided as consideration to the employee, unless the employee breaches the agreement during the garden leave period. And as we talked about on a slide or two ago, there's this idea that if an employee breaches their fiduciary duty or steals property, that the one-year non-compete can be converted into a two-year non-compete. And in that case, you don't actually have to pay garden leave during the second year. That's an exception. And then in kind of contradictory to the first bullet, the second bullet point on this slide, about unilaterally discontinuing, there is in the definition of garden leave, it actually says that an employer can waive garden leave if they waive the employee's non-compete. So if you get to the end of employment and you say this employee is not that important, we're not all that concerned about competition, you can waive the non-compete agreement and therefore you don't have to pay the garden leave. So with that in mind, if we don't have complete clarity, we at least have some guideposts about what consideration is and what's required. So the definition of consideration, of course, is that it requires a benefit to the promisor or a detriment to the promisee. It's a very general description, but that's been long the law in Massachusetts in most places. So what we do know is that garden leave is sufficient and that continued employment is not sufficient. But there's a big delta in between there. And terms like other mutually agreed upon consideration are not defined, nor is fair and reasonable. So what is going to be considered by the courts to be adequate or sufficient consideration? Now, it's long been black letter law in Massachusetts that the courts are not going to assess the adequacy of consideration in a contract. If you provide any consideration, the court is going to typically consider that to be sufficient consideration. It's the old peppercorn analogy that if you went to law school, you heard a lot about. And that comes from this Barnett v. Rosen case from 1920. And that we still think will apply to new employees, where as long as you're providing some level of consideration and you're falling under the other mutually agreed upon consideration, our view is I don't know what the courts will do, but they shouldn't look too deeply into whether that's adequate or not, because that's just not what courts are supposed to do in the consideration context. Now, for existing employees where you have to provide fair and reasonable consideration and continued employment is no longer sufficient, you've now set up a scheme where it has to be something more than the baseline, than the peppercorn. And you'll see in cases from states like Pennsylvania where continued employment has for a long time not been considered sufficient consideration. They'll say things like it's got to be valuable. In that case, what they say is for new employees, the job itself is sufficient. And who knows if that'll carry over to here. But for existing employees, it's got to be a corresponding benefit or change in status, a raise, a promotion, so on and so forth. Now, regardless of what the law is and whether or not the courts should be looking at the adequacy of consideration under the Barnett case and others, typically these cases, as you likely know, are won or lost at the injunction stage. Meaning you're going before the judge to get a preliminary injunction or a temporary restraining order to keep somebody out of work. And in those circumstances, the judge has a lot of discretion and equity is paramount, meaning they're going to look at the fairness of the situation as much as they are the law and what the contract says. And if a judge looks and says, well, you gave them something you were going to give them anyways, that's not enough. If that's the risk, then what's the point? If you can't get an injunction, you could certainly go through and try to get damages. But again, what you're really trying to get in these cases is an injunction. And if what you're doing isn't going to get you there, then what's the point? So now the big question, which is, what is other mutually agreed upon consideration? The vague language we've been talking about. So William Brownsberger, who Kate mentioned at the very beginning, he was one of the primary architects of this law. And in fact, he was the senator who originally came out with the law banning non-competes altogether in Massachusetts. And an article he published this Monday on his, I don't know if it's his blog or his website, after the law was signed by the governor, he said what's written on the screen, and it says, this language, the mutually agreed upon language leaves the door wide open for simply considering some component of usual employment compensation to be incremental consideration for entering into a non-compete agreement. Essentially, what you're already giving them is going to be good enough. And that's very interesting coming from, A, somebody who wrote the bill, and it gets into the legislative history to some degree if you need to go down that road and argue that. But also, this is the guy, again, who wanted to ban non-competes outright, and he's acknowledging that under this watered-down law, you really don't have to do much more than you were already doing for new employees, not existing employees. So here's a list of common types of employment consideration in this context. At the top is continued employment, which we've talked about is not sufficient, and at the bottom is garden leave, which is sufficient. And everything in between, in no particular order, are other types of consideration. And there's, of course, others that aren't on this chart. These are the ones we came up with. You know, the job itself for new employees, that Pennsylvania case we just looked at said that would be sufficient, and it may very well be. A raise or a promotion. Interestingly, signing the agreement under seal, which is certainly not the same as in the old days when you actually used a wax seal, but is still a concept that applies very narrowly in Massachusetts and has been written out of the law in a lot of different contexts. But in this case, it's called EMC versus Donatelli from several years ago. The court expressly found that as one portion of the consideration, the contract was under seal and that the courts had, in fact, not written it out in this context. So again, is that going to be sufficient? And then you go on to signing and bonuses, salary and benefits, eligibility for performance bonuses. Somebody might argue that's illusory because they may never earn it, but the opportunity to earn it, in our view, is sufficient. Specialized training, access to confidential information, trade secrets, and customer goodwill. That is oftentimes an adequate consideration in places like Texas and other states, again, where they're looking at the level of consideration. That type of consideration is common. And then you keep moving on to stock options and grants, commissions, and guaranteed severance, and so on and so forth. So at the end of the day, our view is that the consideration, because the language is so wishy-washy, it's really all going to come down to risk tolerance and looking at what other states are doing. And until there's some case law at the appellate level that comes out and says, this is what the statute means, or this is how we're going to interpret it, you've got to just take your best shot and consider your risk tolerance. If you're willing to have a high risk tolerance, especially if you're employing folks in other states who are where you don't have these restrictions, you don't have this language, then you may very well just go with new employment being sufficient, or new employment and signing under seal, or access to trade secrets. That being said, there really is a difference between new and existing employees in our view because of the language that they included about fair and reasonable consideration for continued employment instead of continued employment for existing employees. That takes you out of this whole scheme of anything is enough and does require, to some degree, the court to perform an analysis of whether it's sufficient. And again, so as far as what we suggest, Don's going to talk largely about that. But on this issue, again, this is a statute that tells you what you can do, must do, and cannot do in a contract. So be clear in the contract what you're doing. Think about what you're willing to provide. Think about first what you're already providing and write it down. Then think about what else you would be willing to provide depending on your risk level. It may be nothing. It may be garden leave. And then in the agreement, have a specific section for consideration and specifically call out what you're giving them so that it's not left to the court to have to figure out using the language that you often see now, which is just that the parties agree that there is consideration. Actually say what that consideration is. Belt and suspenders approach. And again, that's going to come down to your risk tolerance. And now on to Don Burt Knight.
Thank you, Eric. Before I start my section, I'll read the CLE code. It is SS, as in Seyfarth Shaw, 5381. That's SS 5381. So you'll see here we have a slide on the new choice of law and venue requirements. And you'll note that we have requirements in quotes. I'll explain that in just a second, but I won't read the actual full text of the statute, but just give you an overview on what these provisions state. As for choice of law, The statute provides that as long as a departing employee has lived or worked in Massachusetts for at least 30 days preceding termination of his or her employment, a choice of law provision designating another state's law will be unenforceable. As for the venue requirement, the statute provides that litigation related to non-competes must be brought in the county where the employee resides, or if both parties agree, in Suffolk County Superior Court, that includes the business litigation session of Suffolk Superior. Now, why do we have requirements in quotes? Well, it's because we have serious doubts as to whether these provisions will actually be truly requirements in litigation in other states. Obviously, if you have litigation here in Massachusetts, the Massachusetts courts are going to look to the statute and give them full effect. But with respect to choice of law, given principles of state sovereignty, we think there's a good chance that other states will not necessarily follow the requirement of the statute. And in fact, in this room here, the three of us, we have had significant success with a similar California law where we have argued in courts outside of California that choice of law provisions binding California residents are enforceable, notwithstanding the California statute to the contrary. As for venue, you're likely familiar with the Atlantic Marine case, in which the Supreme Court determined that a valid forum selection clause agreed to by the parties would be enforceable in all but the most exceptional cases. We also note that the law does not contemplate jurisdiction in the federal courts. As you may recall from the previous slide, it just said Suffolk Superior Court or the county in which the employee resides. This could be an issue in cases where there is a federal question claim, such as a Defend Trade Secrets Act claim, and you have pendant state law claims, such as a claim for breach of a non-compete agreement, based on the same underlying facts. Now, of course, if you have a DTSA claim that is brought in federal court, we think it's highly unlikely that a defendant would convince a federal judge that he or she cannot hear the pendant state court claims because of the statute, but it does make it a little bit murky and tricky. So from our perspective, it may not be necessary to change your agreements to conform to this law for Massachusetts employees. From our perspective, the worst case scenario is that you might have an employee or independent contractor who filed a declaratory judgment action in Massachusetts, and the choice of law and venue provisions that are in your agreement, providing for some other forum or another state's law, are deemed unenforceable by the Massachusetts court. But there is nothing in the law as drafted that suggests that an unenforceable choice of law or venue provision will render the rest of the agreement unenforceable. So from that perspective, it's fairly low risk. Obviously, you'll want to make sure that your agreement complies with Massachusetts law in case either the employee does bring a declaratory judgment action in Massachusetts, or if another state's court determines that the Massachusetts law and venue provision should apply. So you want to make sure that the agreement hews fairly closely to the requirements of this new statute. The statute also provides that a court can reform or otherwise revise a non-compete agreement to render it valid and enforceable if it's overbroad, and the court can do so to the extent necessary to protect the employer's legitimate business interests. That is not a change from existing law. That's been the case here in Massachusetts, that courts can reform agreements, but this just codifies that. And you may have heard some commentators have referenced this being a blue pencil provision. That's not actually accurate. The blue pencil doctrine is a lot more narrow than reformation. Under the blue pencil doctrine, the only thing a court could do would be to strike out offending words and see if the remaining language is enforceable. The courts here can actually do a lot more than that. So let's say, for example, in your agreement, it states that an employee can't compete anywhere within 100 miles. Under the blue pencil doctrine, if a court determined that that was overbroad, they would strike out the 100 miles, but they couldn't put anything in, and therefore the entire provision would fail. In reformation states, including Massachusetts, and again, this is not new, the court can reform it and add something new into the agreement. So let's say in that same example, the court determines that 100 miles is overbroad, but 50 miles would be acceptable. The court can strike out the 100 miles and only apply the agreement in a 50-mile radius. So again, that's not new. That just codifies the existing law. The one thing we will note, however, you still need to be careful to use reasonable agreements that comply with Massachusetts law. Judges do not like it when employers draft really outlandish agreements in the hopes that an employee either won't challenge it because they don't know any better, or that a court will scale it back. So you need to be careful that you're not really going overboard, just assuming that a court will reform it. You'll see that consideration is not subject to reformation. So as Eric mentioned earlier, you want to make sure that employees bound by these agreements have valid consideration that is specified in the agreement itself. So some other things that haven't changed with this law. Under the common law, the material change doctrine, as far as I know, Massachusetts is really the only state in the country that follows this doctrine, which essentially means that an employment agreement, a non-compete agreement, is potentially unenforceable if the employee's job, including responsibilities, compensation, other roles, if that materially changes, the agreement may not be enforceable. And that can be the case whether the change in the employee's role is a promotion or a demotion. We've seen both cases, and in both cases, we've seen courts render the or determine that the agreements are unenforceable. However, provisions in a non-compete agreement that state that a material change will not render the agreement unenforceable are regularly enforced. So if you anticipate, or even if you don't anticipate, that an employee who signs one of these agreements may at some point down the road have their job materially changed, you'll want to include a provision that states that any such change will not render the agreement unenforceable. So we would advise including that in all of your agreements. Another thing that won't change is this question of who owns customer goodwill. We see this a lot, especially with litigation involving sales folks, whether the employee or the employer is the entity that owns the goodwill. And as Eric had mentioned, that's one of the touchstones for legitimate business interests, so it's very important in these cases. This law doesn't change that issue, and we expect that to be an issue in litigation going forward. You should always think about equitable considerations. Eric mentioned earlier that agreements longer than 1 year are unenforceable, but you shouldn't assume that that means a one-year restriction will be enforceable. And again, this is all very fact-specific, so there very well may be cases where a court determines that a particular employee really should only be restricted for 3 months or 6 months, even if in most cases 1 year will be enforceable. So keep in mind the facts associated with the particular individual you're seeking to bind. You should always consider using other restrictive covenants to protect your assets. We've talked about that again earlier today. That would include potentially severance agreements, which are not subject to the law, as we mentioned, provided that the employee is expressly given a 7-day revocation period. And finally, beware of no poaching agreements. That's fairly risky, and authorities have been cracking down on these agreements, so you want to be mindful of that. Moving on to statutory considerations, this bill, the same economic development bill, adopted a version of the Uniform Trade Secret Act, or UTSA, which means that New York is now the only other the only state in the country that has not adopted a version of the UTSA. The UTSA is similar to what we previously had in Massachusetts, but there are some significant differences, so I want to mention those. First, the UTSA protects trade secrets with actual or potential economic value. Previously in Massachusetts, only trade secrets with actual value were protected, and even then only if they were used in one's business. Under the UTSA, Even if a trade secret is not actively being used, it can still be protected by the statute. With the adoption of the UTSA, the question is whether Massachusetts will also adopt the inevitable disclosure doctrine. Most states that have adopted a version of the UTSA do follow the inevitable disclosure doctrine. Massachusetts has been an outlier, but again, that's most likely because it hadn't adopted the UTSA. So we suspect that courts will start to apply that now. Similarly, the UTSA purports to supersede conflicting laws regarding misappropriation, and the question that that raises is whether claims under Chapter 93A, which you'll see on this slide, are generally inapplicable in the employment context, but there's an exception for trade secret misappropriation. There's a question whether the adoption of the UTSA will now render Chapter 93A claims inapplicable to trade secret misappropriation. And that's potentially significant because Chapter 93A provides for treble damages in certain circumstances, whereas the UTSA only provides for double damages. So we'll have to see how that plays out. There's also a question of whether the UTSA would supersede common law tort for misappropriation of confidential business information. That's information that is confidential but doesn't necessarily rise to the definition of a trade secret. And again, we'll have to see how courts deal with that. Different states have taken different approaches, so it is not clear, just based on the text of the statute, which way Massachusetts will go. And finally, the last thing to note about the UTSA is that it includes a shifting fees provision. So employers need to be very careful when they're bringing a UTSA claim now, because if the court ultimately determines that the claim was brought in bad faith, the plaintiff could be on the hook for defendant's legal fees. The DTSA, Defend Trade Secrets Act, many of you have probably heard of this. That is also still in play. And again, I mentioned earlier that that might create some tension when it comes to jurisdiction. And there's some other statutes that still may apply, the CFAA, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, Stored Communications Act, and criminal penalties may be available. And we've had some clients contact the FBI when trade secret theft has risen to that level. So what should you do now? So before October 1st, if you want to go beyond the statutory limits of what the new law requires, now's the time to get agreements like that signed if you're going to do it. But just be aware that that's still risky because, as we mentioned, courts have a wide latitude to reform agreements and limit them. And we could see courts determining that an agreement, even if it's not in violation of the law, is against public policy, and so you need to be careful about that. Obviously, you'll want to get new agreements that comply with the law ready to go for any employees starting October 1st or thereafter. You will want to get a sense of who the excluded individuals are that are no longer subject to non-compete agreements if you're going to have those folks sign on or after October 1st. You'll want to limit the scope carefully of your agreements to fit within the guidelines, as Eric had mentioned earlier. Obviously, very important to provide the mandated notice period and also to identify consideration very carefully. Eric talked about that at length. And again, think about the choice of law and venue provisions. It may not be something that you need or want to change, but it is something to consider whether you need to have for certain Massachusetts employees, different provisions. As always, it's important to protect your trade secrets and confidential information beyond just the use of non-compete agreements. We talked about other types of agreements, but also you may want to consider a trade secret audit to determine whether your company is really taking all the steps necessary to protect its assets. You will also want to consider updating various policies and forensic capabilities for that purpose. The second bullet here, you'll see shore up your customer, vendor, and employee relationships. That's obviously very important in protecting your assets. When it comes to departing employees or independent contractors, You should regularly conduct exit interviews, remind departing employees of their obligations to the company, both at the exit interview stage and in writing, and we would recommend that you attach a copy of the relevant agreement to any such writing so that they have it in front of them. Consider forensic reviews, or at the very least, forensic imaging of employees' devices for future use. Consider severance agreements with the required notice or for-cause termination. And Kate talked a little bit about that earlier. You have to be somewhat careful, and that might still give rise to litigation, but it's something to consider. And last but definitely not least, give your employees a reason to remain loyal. So we've only got a few minutes left. I will do a very quick rundown. We talked about a lot today, but a summary of the statutory requirements. They only apply to non-compete agreements, which includes forfeiture for competition agreements. Certain types of individuals are excluded, including those who are exempt under the FLSA, 18 years or younger, individuals who've been laid off or terminated without cause, certain students. But again, severance agreements are permissible with the 7-day revocation period. So keep that in mind for individuals who might otherwise be excluded. The agreements must be in writing and signed by both parties, and they must expressly state that the individual has had the right to consult with counsel prior to signing. And the notice provision, again, is very important. They must be provided to new employees upon the formal offer letter or 10 business days before commencement of employment, whichever is earlier. And notice must be provided to existing employees at least 10 business days before the effective date of the agreement. They're limited to 1 year unless there's been a breach of fiduciary duty or theft of property, in which case the agreement might be extended to 2 years. You need to make sure that there are actually protectable interests and a good reason for having these agreements. The scope must be thought about carefully. You want to make sure that both the geographic scope and the scope of prescribed activities is reasonable. For consideration, again, that's a big change. You need something more than continued employment for existing employees, and that consideration must be fair and reasonable. And for new employees, 50% garden leave or some other mutually agreed upon consideration specified in the agreement. Again, we talked a little bit about how confusing and uncertain that is, but you'll need to take into consideration your company's risk tolerance. The statute provides that no out-of-state choice of law or venue provisions will be permissible, but we have serious doubt that that will actually be upheld by other states' courts. And again, the court can, as they always have been, they have the ability to reform overbroad restrictions. And as Eric mentioned, this is just merely governing what must be included in private contracts, and it does very little beyond that context. So we've got 2 minutes. We'll show you real quick here. We, all three of us, blog on the CyFarth Trading Secrets blog, www.tradesecretslaw.com, very easy to remember. And that's that goes well beyond Massachusetts cases. There obviously has been a lot of blogging on Massachusetts, and that's why we're all here. But this website provides case updates and other tidbits for all across the country. So we urge you to check that out. We have the slide for questions, but unfortunately on our screen, we can't see the questions, and we only have 2 minutes anyways. So what we would urge you to do is contact one of us. We have our contact information up here, and we would be happy to talk to you. We know that this new law has raised a lot of questions. Folks are fairly concerned about what this means for their business, and we're happy to help with that. And that concludes our presentation. We hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.